the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey guys, this is Bobby Golden. We're coming back at you with another rice podcast from the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast team. As always, I have Dr. Jason Bond in the studio with me and a special guest, Dr. Steve Linscombe of the USA Rice Federation and Foundation. Correct, two titles. But today, what he's going to be talking about with us is his time spent working in the rice industry as a scientist with the LSU Ag Center. So, Steve, we're glad you were able to join us today, and it's an honor to have you on.
Well, it's an honor to be on with you today, and I really look forward to doing this. This is actually my first endeavor here with a podcast, and it's pretty interesting. You guys do a very good job with it.
We appreciate that. Yeah, we were talking a minute ago before we hit the record button, and you were asking what our crop looked like in Mississippi, and you know, my comment was, you know, looks good with the exception of the grass. And those of you that have been listening to these rice episodes through the summer, you know, that's a dead horse here. We've talked about grass quite a bit, you know.
We beat it with the stick, we beat it with the 2x4, we stuck the 2x4 in it,
and all that grass is still there.
It hadn't went anywhere. It has not went anywhere.
My guys are going to get on some of it though. We're gonna come pull some, and we figure we had a good year to do a barnyard grass survey and see what our, you know, herbicide response.
The greenhouse will be hot this fall.
Yeah, I mean, you might as well take advantage of make something good out of having all that grass available.
But we're not like any of the other states. I know there's problems in Arkansas,
absolutely,
problems in Louisiana. What have you been seeing, Steve?
Well, I've been seeing a little bit of rice, primarily in Texas and in Louisiana as well. You know, we're cutting rice in the South, well into the harvest in Louisiana. I guess in general we're hearing that we've got some very good yields. We've got some pretty good yields, and we've got some fields that just for various reasons has not done as well as we expected them to do. We thought we would have a good crop in Louisiana this year because, you know, our weather has been very decent down there. Not a lot of hot weather, not a lot of hot, high nighttime temperatures. So I think we've got in South Louisiana at least, have a above average crop, but certainly I don't think we have a record crop.
Yeah, I think our crop looks very good here if you take the grass out of it. And, you know, what about 10, 15 days ago, we got a call with the guys growing 45, 34. They were starting to pull the boards and drain the field. So our first rice that'll come off up here will probably come off next week, and it will be that early season high.
Yeah, and I've talked to a few farmers in Texas as well, and I think they've got a decent crop there. I did hear a comment from one today saying his yields were about 10% off compared to last year, primarily because of grass. So the grass issues you're talking about up here in the north part of the growing region also extend down into the south as well.
You know, working for USA Rice now, but you spent a long time with the LSU Ag Center, the stuff that you turned out, man, just is mind-boggling. I mean, the variety.
Well, I'll just say it. It changed the rice industry in the Mid-South.
Absolutely, it did. You know, Cypress, Kokodry, Bengal, Chenier, you know, Clearfield, the whole Clearfield system. And I know that was a team effort, but definitely, you know, you were heavily involved in those varieties. So, man, just kind of give us, you know, looking back on that, what are you most proud of in the time that you spent, you know, with the Ag Center in Louisiana?
Well, you know, and I started with the Ag Center in 82, and a lot of people don't realize the first 6 years of my career, I was actually the rice specialist in Louisiana. In 87, Dr. Kent McKenzie, who was a breeder at Crowley, who is now the director of the Rice Experiment Station in California, he left. And before he left, he said, you know, you ought to think about taking this breeding job. And I thought about it, and I applied for it, and I moved over to the rice station in 1988, and we were there for almost 30 years. And we were fortunate to release a lot of quite a few rice varieties. Some of them did very, very well, but I also have to say that some of the ones I thought were going to be home runs turned out not to be home runs. That's just the way it worked.
Well, yeah. I think you had more hits than misses.
Well, we did, and you mentioned it before talking about the Clearfield. We have had a very good research team at the station during my career, and a lot of the people there that I work with through the years had a huge amount to do with how successful we were in variety development. Whether that was Pat Bollock, Jason, you helped for a while when you were at Crowley, certainly. You know, Dr. Don Groth, Dr. Mike Stout, as well as some of the other entomologists we work with through the years, Dustin Harrell, who replaced you at Crowley. We just had a very good team, but and also the people that work with me directly in the breeding project at Crowley were instrumental in the success of that project. But you know, one thing I will say is I probably retired at a good time because things are changing dramatically in breeding in a lot of different respects. But one of the more important ones is the impact that marker-assisted selection is going to have going forward in rice variety development. Adam Famoso, who replaced me, is a breeder in Crowley. He's going to do a phenomenal job. He has already really moved the marker-assisted work directly into the breeding program, and I expect really accelerated returns to come from that. And that's not just at Crowley. All of the breeding programs are going to incorporate that technology, and I'm just excited about what we're going to see coming down the road with rice varieties. The other thing that was very important to the industry is the rice hybrids from a yield standpoint. And just about every state has a hybrid program now. Certainly Rice Tech led the way in rice hybrids, but I think that you're going to see some hybrids coming out of other institutes and other entities moving forward. We just need to get the quality improved in the rice hybrids, and I think that's coming.
What do you think, you know, aside from your work at the station in Crowley, I know you were really involved in just the rice industry in general and in rice production. So during that time frame from when you were the rice specialist on up, what do you think's the biggest advancement that we've made, you know, production-wise?
Well, you know, if you look at, for example, just in Louisiana, the year I started with the Ag Center, I think the average yield in Louisiana that year was 3,800 pounds per acre. And a couple of years ago, we had a crop that was 7,500 pounds per acre. So we have seen some dramatic increases all throughout the southern United States in just overall yields.
Yeah, here in Mississippi, we're, you know, last 4 or 5 years averaging around 7,400 pounds.
And you know, there's not one thing, Jason, I think varieties certainly are very, very important here. But if you look at improvements that have come about in fungicides, if you look at improvements that have come about in herbicides, and, you know, I think our producers are just doing a lot better job as managers. I think they do a lot better job at seeding, at getting good stands. Certainly, we've got planting equipment that is dramatically improved over what we had 35 years ago. And, you know, just some of the things like the treatments on fertilizer that prevent fertilizer loss. And I think our producers are doing a better job of managing crops, watering the crops across the board. So there's a lot of improvements that have been made in the industry in my career.
Well, you talked about planting and seeding. And, you know, we had Nathan Slayton on a couple weeks ago, and he said, point blank, in this year with the weather that they had experienced in Arkansas, he doesn't know how he ever worked without seed treatments and how much those seed treatments had meant to getting a viable stand.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and very important today is you know, some of the seed treatments, especially the fungicides, but some of the insecticidal seed treatments are extremely beneficial to getting a good stand and making sure that at least early season we've got some of these major insects that are not causing the problems they could be causing.
I'm still kind of stuck on, you know, how things have changed, but, you know, during this the time frame that you work, off the top of your head, what's kind of the kookiest thing you can think of that you've ever seen on a rice farm?
I guess the first time I found an alligator nest in a rice field, that was kind of unique. It was down in some reclaimed marshland. And what was funny about it is I knew what an alligator nest looked like, but it just so happened.
Because your brother was big in the.
Yeah, my brother had a career with the Louisiana Wildlife and Fisheries Commission doing research on fur bearers and alligators. So I spent a lot of time with him, and, you know, when I was younger, even rob eggs out of alligator nests. So I knew what an alligator nest looked like. I just so happened when we found it down in South Vermilion Parish, I had a visiting breeder from Japan with me. And that changed his life when he saw that alligator coming towards us in that field right there. But that was kind of a unique experience. And, you know, the other thing I'd say from a career standpoint, I really got the opportunity to travel a lot. I think that at last count in my career working in rice, I've been to maybe 62 different countries.
Wow.
For a while there, it's going to be nice not to travel quite so much moving forward. You know, in my new career, we do have an international trip every year, so I will continue to be able to travel a little bit.
Yeah, I know I called you one time a couple of years ago just for a random question, and you were in China.
Yeah, I was in the truck with you when you did that.
All right, why don't you call me back when you're more convenient?
Dealing with the neck blast issue. I think that's exactly what it was.
Actually, it's a lot of times it's easier to talk when you're in China than when you're in Crowley. So
maybe maybe the phone's not beeping in as much.
Yeah, China was a place that I probably went to, I'd guess, 12 or 15 times in my career. So I traveled to China. We worked fairly closely, or we work fairly closely with a couple of, actually three, agricultural research centers in China. People, I think, don't realize, they kind of have a misconception when scientists travel that we're giving away our technology. But I can tell you that's not the case, because in my travels through my career, I brought back a lot more to the research station in Crowley from the standpoint of germplasm, technology, you name it, than we ever gave away.
Well, everybody does things differently, and you can always learn from someone else. Even within the Mid-South, the way we do things differently, but especially when, you know, you think about China or overseas or Australia or Spain or where they grow rice, they might have one thing that could help us out.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've brought back a lot of those one things, and I can tell you one thing that we brought back is technology for evaluating for blast disease that I first saw in Brazil. And basically we know that blast, under unflooded conditions, blast is always worse. So what this scientist was doing, he would create kind of like a pretty deep furrow. And he'd have all of his rice lines where the line was planted on the top of the furrow and in the bottom of the furrow. So the bottom of the furrow was always flooded, and the top of the furrow was always unflooded. So it was a very good way, when he would inoculate with blast, to see which of those lines were more resistant, especially more resistant where the rice was not flooded. So that's something we saw in Brazil, and we brought it back to Louisiana to use in our blast evaluation. It's just a very good example.
And that's going to be huge right now, where especially in the upper Mid-South, North Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, where we're seeing these row rice acres blow up overnight almost.
Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, we've always had row rice throughout my career. It was big in Missouri early on. I think it was being attempted when the technology was not quite where it needed to be. It has come on, like Bobby said, within the last few years. I think there's a lot of potential for row rice, and we have people out there that are proving that. But certainly, as Bobby said, the first thing you need to do if you're going to grow row rice is make sure that you don't have a blast susceptible variety, because it will eat your lunch.
Jason and I walked in a field the other day to look at a blast issue, and we wasn't told it was a row rice field. And Jason said, "You go on that side to turn row, I'll go on this side to turn row." And when he hit the first furrow, that was
tripping over beds. Steve, speaking of blast, why, and maybe it's just me, but it seems to me like the incidence of blast has been more, at least in our geography, the last 3 or 4 years than it was, say, the 3 or 4 years prior to that. Do you get that sense? And if so, what's your idea on why that is?
So blast, really, in my career, has always been kind of cyclical. So some years are bad blast years, and some years you just don't see it. And I'll give you a very good example. We've got the new Provisia variety that was being grown more or less commercially for the first time this year, and I'm very concerned about that because it is susceptible to blast disease, and we're just not seeing a lot of blasts in South Louisiana so far this year, and hopefully, you know, it won't be a huge issue up here. But you know, you have certain conditions that are more conducive for blast. I think, you know, one thing we see is a lot of times when it's a very dry year, we normally think that's good, and it normally is because it means you're not getting a lot of rainfall, not a lot of cloud cover. But the other side of that coin is it's a lot more difficult to keep fields flooded. And if you're losing a flood on the field and you got a blast susceptible variety and you've got blast floating around out there, you're going to find out very quickly that it's a problem not having a flood on that rice. So, I think if anything, we're growing a higher percentage of blast resistant varieties, but we still do have some blast susceptible varieties. And we just get into certain environmental conditions that make blast more of an issue we have to deal with.
You know, and here in Mississippi, a lot of the varieties that we prefer that are non-hybrids are susceptible.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do have some good blast resistance genes out there. And I was speaking earlier about some of the marker technology that is going to expedite getting stacked blast genes in future varieties. But, you know, we still have some varieties that are very popular varieties that are susceptible to blast. And I'll use an example of one that we released is CL151, which is probably, at least for a long time, was the highest yielding non-hybrid we had out there. But it was very susceptible and it is very susceptible to blast disease. So that's just something that we had to be very cognizant of if we were growing the variety.
Well, I think you talk about something like 151 that had to stay in power, even though it might have had blast susceptibility. There's not one silver bullet variety out there. So you got to pick what works best for you.
Well,
right?
And that's you make a very good point. What scares me more than anything is when a producer says they've got their entire crop in one variety.
And that's not all that uncommon, right?
Yeah, it isn't. And a very close friend of mine in Texas is 100% 151. And I just cringe when I think about that. But he has done a very good job with it, and it's still a high-performing variety for him. I will give you another example talking, I've been harping on the marker-assisted selection. So we released a variety, CL111, a number of years ago that for a long time was the most widely grown variety in Louisiana. It didn't do comparatively that well in Mississippi or Arkansas. But when Adam Famoso at the station started looking at our head rows, and that's another thing we use the marker-assisted work with is to, in our seed production, to try to fine-tune our head rows, he found out that about 30% of the 111 head rows had the PETA gene for blast resistance, and 70% did not. So what he was able to do with that knowledge is go in there and take 111, which was a fairly blast susceptible variety, and now the 111 that's out there is blast resistant. So it's just another example of what you can do with some of these technologies that are moving into our science that'll really help moving forward.
Steve, man, you know, I don't know that anybody has as good a handle on the rice industry and rice production as you do. What do you see, you know, kind of going forward 5 years, 10 years for the rice industry and, you know, maybe even, you know, farm-level production too?
Yeah, you know, I always say here in Mississippi, if you've heard me speak, we're generally a roller coaster ride. We'll drop as many acres overnight as we'll pick up the next year. Do you see that stabilizing? Or,
you know, one thing that, and that's all market driven. I mean, everybody that's out there knows that, you know, if rice is a more favorable crop to grow, they're gonna grow rice. One thing about rice is it's, you know, it's not immune to crop failure, but because at least most of it is grown under flooded conditions, it's less potential to have a complete loss of the crop. The reason it's probably gonna continue to be a roller coaster is that our rice prices are dictated a long way from here. I mean, you know, we're, as we talked talked about here in the United States, we're about a little over 50% domestically consumed, and almost half of our rice crop goes into the international market. You know, what the international market, what the price of Thai rice, what the price of Vietnamese rice. Right now, India is a big player in the export market. That, to a large extent, drives what our price here is in the United States. That's probably always going to be kind of a roller coaster ride. So, unfortunately, going forward, you're probably still going to see that. I would think if we could get domestic consumption a little bit higher, that would give us a little bit more stability. But, you know, it's the fact that we're in a big-time international market just makes it difficult to control the price of rice.
So we're not going to out-yield ourselves out of this problem.
I don't think that that's something we'll see going forward. I would hope that, you know, we've seen some steady yield increases, certainly in my career, and I think the technology is out there to continue to see those yield increases. I think that, you know, hybrids have been very important there, but we need to get the quality cleaned up in the hybrids, and I think we'll do that going forward. Do I think we're ever going to be 100% hybrid? I do not. I think that in rice moving forward, we're going to see more and more specialty types grown, whether that's aromatics, whether that's jasmine types, a renewed interest in basmati types out there, some interest in actually in the South and the Muchi types are the sweet rices. So, you know, that's where we need to go. We need to diversify. One of my coworkers at Crowley has actually developed a higher protein rice. It's being grown commercially, surprisingly, in the state of Illinois by a very good grower there. So I think that the specialty rices are going to continue to play an important role. And I think that it's just an example. Y'all grow a lot of contract rice.
We grow an awful lot of contract
here,
rice in Mississippi.
And I think that is the ticket. I think that if you can have a guaranteed price of rice going in when you're planting that crop, that gives you a lot better sense of security. It's been my pleasure here to visit with y'all today. And again, my pleasure to sit with these two young scientists that are just doing a really good job for the rice producers of Mississippi and the Gulf South as a whole.
Well, we sure appreciate you coming on, Steve, and we'd love to have you back on again if you'll have us. Joy, always talking to you in here in 62 countries. And I was upset about leaving the country for the first time next week. I'm not going to talk anymore about it, Jason.
Maybe we can record a podcast from Steve's cabin in Colorado.
That would be nice. Don't pick the week that is hot out there.
Yeah.
Well, again, we appreciate you coming on, Steve, and we look forward to having you on many more episodes. And always, guys, if you like what you're hearing, give us a shout. And if you need us to come look at your field, we're just a phone call away.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.